farmers, hunters, irrigators, and ducks.
I mean, there's a full assault on these wetlands during that time period.
A conversation with Bob Wilson about the history of the Pacific Flyway Refuge System. I'm Sean Karaj, and you're listening to episode 21 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. Migratory birds, by the nature of their behavior, cross boundaries. They are a transnational species whose habitat in North America ranges from the Canadian Arctic in the north to Mexico in the south. As such, the human conservation of these species has historically been complicated by the challenge of managing a mobile resource. The 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty between Canada and the United States was one example of the need to work across borders in order to conserve these species of birds. But even within national borders, the conservation of migratory birds faces transboundary challenges. One of the greatest threats to migratory wildfowl on the Pacific coast of North America was the draining and destruction of wetlands in the U.S. West, particularly in the state of California. By the early 20th century, irrigation agriculture dominated the landscape of most of the former wetland wintering range of migratory birds. As such, the U.S. Bureau of Biological Survey, later the Fish and Wildlife Service, set out to establish a system of refuges to conserve and protect migratory wildfowl along what came to be known as the Pacific Flyway. To learn more, I spoke with Bob Wilson about his new book, Seeking Refuge: Birds and Landscapes of the Pacific Flyway.
Okay, my name is Bob Wilson, and I am a professor of geography at Syracuse University in upstate New York.
Thanks for joining us, Bob, and thanks for coming and telling us a little bit more about your book. I guess right off the start here, I was wondering if you could explain to listeners what a flyway is and how this concept was first developed.
Sure. The flyway, at its most basic, is a flyway is just a major migratory bird route for birds. In some ways, you can see it as kind of a constellation of migratory bird routes for different birds. In North America, there are four flyways going from east to west. There's the Atlantic, the Mississippi, the Central, and the Pacific Flyway. And the Pacific Flyway was the migratory bird corridor that I studied for my book. In terms of how the concept was developed, of course, both hunters and bird watchers and early ornithologists knew that birds in North America had this general seasonal, roughly north-south migratory pattern for many, many decades. Mm-hmm. But it was only in the late 19th and early 20th century that ornithologists in a major way began not only studying this migration, but trying to collect data to assess where the birds were actually going back and forth from. In the late teens, 20s, and into the 30s, there was a gentleman who worked for the Bureau of Biological Survey, which is the agency that would eventually become the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, mm-hmm. and Frederick Lincoln was a biologist for them. And he compiled ornithological and migration data in Washington, D.C. For many years, and based on this material that was coming in from primarily what are called bird banding studies, he was able to assess and make an argument there were actually four major migratory routes in North America, and that's basically developed by the late 20s and early 1930s.
And what was the impact of this research then? How did this change government's approach to the protection of wildfowl?
Well, it had quite an important effect. In the decades before the flyway was developed, the United States and to some extent Canada as well had set up wildlife refuges for migratory birds. Many of these refuges were also called bird reservations at the time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, many of these refuges had been set up, but they weren't really set up in a systematic manner, and certainly not set up in a way to protect migratory routes is that they're kind of like links in a chain. But once the flyway concept is developed, it enabled ornithologists and wildlife managers in both countries, but particularly the United States, to see these individual marshes and wetlands that these birds depended on during their migrations as links in a system, and that if you were going to protect these birds, the refuges needed to be, like I said earlier, like links in a chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're able to come up with a more systematic approach to it. And they do that in earnest in the 1930s.
So what got you interested in the Pacific Flyway refuge system, and what were some of the main research questions that you had when you started this project?
Sure. I mean, this is sure, it's a good example of how serendipity really factors into this. In the years it took me to finish this project, the assumption was that I must be a real avid birder, or I must be a bird hunter or something like that. And neither are really the case. I was very interested in water issues in Western North America before I came to graduate school, but this is a very well-studied topic, so I was looking for something new and exciting and intellectually, at least something that I thought was intellectually important to research. And I paid a visit to what's called the Rifle Bird Sanctuary near Vancouver, British Columbia, while I was a graduate student there. And I was going to see the snow geese, very famous, beautiful birds. I wanted to go see these birds in the refuge, but when I began to approach the refuge, I noticed that most of the birds were in the farm fields, and there were very few birds in the refuge, and I thought that was kind of ironic that the birds didn't seem to go to the place in the landscape that we had designated for them. But as I began to think and do a little more research, I realized that nobody had really done work on this. And so as a geographer, and I consider myself an environmental historian as well as a geographer, but if I was going to do a project on environmental history, I wanted to bring my tools and talents as a geographer. And it seemed migratory birds were a great topic to study because migratory birds cross every border a modern nation state has constructed, the border between nations, the borders between states and provinces, and as I would later learn, most importantly, the borders between private land and public land. And so that was kind of the core idea that I was really looking at, about trying to manage an aspect of nature that doesn't adhere to the borders we have laid on the landscape for them.
So I guess that lays a bit of the groundwork for my next question here in terms of what precipitated the need to develop wildfowl refuges in Pacific North America, and particularly California, which is the main focus of your research by the early 20th century.
Well, as the late 19th and certainly early 20th century progresses, the wetlands that these birds depend on to survive, we're talking about ducks and geese and swans, that to various degrees are somewhat dependent on these wetlands. There's a full assault on these wetlands during that time period. There was being drained predominantly to make way for agricultural land. And wetlands are very, as Ann Velisis, the environmental historian, has shown, and through much of U.S. and I would even say Canadian history, wetlands were not very valued landscape. And so these landscapes are being, the water are being drained, and the area is being turned into farmland. And California, by, say, the 1930s or 1940s, has lost 90% of its wetlands, which is the greatest wetland loss in any state, and so migratory bird numbers are beginning to plummet because they're losing habitat and also because of overhunting.
And you make the case, too, that the loss of habitat in any part along the flyway disrupts these species.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at, the Pacific Flyway is particularly lopsided in the degree of damage to habitat. In California, which is a place where about 60% of waterfowl spend the winter months or the cooler months. So it's a very important area for migratory birds. So that area has lost 90% of its wetlands. But if you look at a place like, say, Alaska has lost less than 5% of its wetlands. And so it doesn't matter if you have perfect, pristine habitat from a duck's perspective in Alaska if you don't have a place where they can spend the other parts of the year. So you have to have these links in the chain if these birds are going to survive.
So in the southern range, then, you make the case that marshlands for this period in North American history are seen as valueless spaces or waste?
Exactly. They're seen as something to reclaim, and as most environmental historians would know who might listen to this podcast, but maybe other people too, is, you know, there's a major agency in the United States called the Bureau of Reclamation, but I think the word is very revealing in the sense that this is a fallen landscape that needs to be reclaimed and redeemed in a way, and the way you did that was by draining it and turning it into agricultural into turning it into agricultural land.
So how did the wildlife refuges developed by the Biological Survey and then the Fish and Wildlife Service later differ from parks then?
Well, they differed from say, national parks in a major ways because these are places where hunting, though not all of the early refuges, but certainly later ones where hunting was going to be allowed, they're going to be intensely modified landscapes where you're going to build dikes and canals and ponds so the agency can manipulate water, because that's the principal way that they're going to manage these species, is by managing, by manipulating water. And in the national parks in both of our countries, there's been more of an attempt to, at least in some instances, have more of a hands-off policy and less willingness to at least modify the environment to the degree to which you modify refuges. Obviously, parks have been modified in many ways, as we know. But the degree of modification and the willingness to do it, I think in both areas, is strikingly different. And so the refuges are never seen, at least in the southern part of the flyway, as wilderness areas. I mean, these are intensively managed landscapes in larger landscapes that are already intensively managed primarily for industrial irrigated agriculture.
And this is probably one of the most fascinating and revealing parts of the book, that sense in which these refuges are highly managed environments by the Fish and Wildlife Service. Perhaps you could explain a little bit more how the relationship between the Bureau of Reclamation and the Fish and Wildlife Service ended up shaping the refuge system in the West.
In some of the areas that I study, in the Klamath Basin, which is a place located on the Oregon-California border, it is sort of like a Serengeti for migratory birds. In the late 50s and early, particularly in the 1950s, you would have up to 6 million ducks and geese congregating for a few weeks in this area. So it's just a stunning cornucopia of wildlife. But this is also a place where the Bureau of Reclamation, this water development agency, at a federal water development agency, one of the first places where it undertook a major irrigation project. And shortly after they start this project, you also set up a refuge, the lower Klamath Refuge, and then there are other refuges that follow in the same general vicinity. And they're basically set up in the middle of this agricultural landscape, and from the early 1900s all the way up to this very day, there is a conflict between the demands of the Bureau of Reclamation and the farmers that it serves with irrigation water and the needs of wildlife, because both the wildlife refuges and the farms require water to function, irrigation water for the farms and water to support marshes and shallow lakes for the birds. Mm-hmm. And so there's an inherent conflict right there in the exact same general landscape.
Mm-hmm. And now, do the refuges by and large become the recipients of drained water from the irrigated landscape surrounding them?
Exactly. Under the Western water system, at least in many parts of the West, there is a system of prior appropriation where there is a first-in-time, first-in-right. So there is a seniority in water system, and the refuges are often very junior in their water rights, or they don't have water rights at all, and so they just get the leftover water, the wastewater or drain water, from irrigation operations further upstream, if you will. And so the water that is flowing in the basin is basically the leftovers. And so if you look at a map of, say, the Klamath Basin created by the Bureau of Reclamation, the refuges will be named sumps. But for the Fish and Wildlife Service, they're refuges. And so the sump is revealing because essentially for the Fish and Wildlife Service, what these refuges serve is a place for wastewater to go. The irrigated system doesn't function unless you have a place for the wastewater to go. And so we've tried, as Americans, to create a refuge system on the cheap, and the way that you do that is by using this wastewater from agriculture to serve a double purpose, as water to support a habitat for migratory birds.
This is, again, one of the most interesting parts of the book, but the refuge system doesn't disrupt the system of irrigation, which changed that landscape then. These aren't restored marshlands. These are a part of that irrigated landscape.
they're completely part of it. I say that if you think of in one way, and it's not a perfect metaphor, is the irrigated landscape as a very complicated plumbing system. Essentially, the fish and wildlife refuges become units within this larger plumbing system. So 200 years ago, you would have had these marshes that had not been, obviously Native American people have been using them, but they've not been mm-hmm. extensively modified in terms of draining them. Mm-hmm. And so then many of these wetlands are extensively drained by irrigators, but it's after that, often after that, the refuges are set up and extensively managed. And so in some cases, the wetlands are completely gone, and they have to start from scratch and use new sources of water, and the new source of water comes from these irrigation operations.
Now, some listeners in Southern California might be familiar with a really large body of water that's become home to wildfowl. Can you explain the origins of the Salton Sea?
Sure. I mean, the Salton Sea, I think is just one of the most amazing spots in from an environmental perspective in the western United States. And the Salton Sea is located very near the California-Mexico border, and it's created by an accident in the early 20th century from an irrigation project that kind of goes awry. Waters are being diverted from the Colorado River into the Imperial Valley, but there's a flood down the Colorado River, and it breaches some of the water structures that had been set up. And then you have water flowing into this basin that's below sea level, the Imperial Valley, and it fills a lot of that basin up and creates a very large lake, which is actually called the Salton Sea. So it's created by an accident. But this isn't a place that only gets a few inches of rainfall a year, and there's no natural outlet for the sea, and so a lot of the water is evaporating. But what has sustained the sea for a decade since then is, again, this wastewater from irrigated agriculture, so excess water flowing into the sea. But as the years have gone on, that sea has become saltier and saltier and saltier. But during that meantime as well, it's become an important haven for migratory birds. And so even though this is not a natural spot, as most of us would conceive of that word, mm-hmm. this is a sea that was created by people, it's become extremely important for migratory birds.
Now, listeners may be asking right away, if the refuges are sumps for irrigated agriculture, then they must be subject to the residue of chemical pesticides and herbicides used to produce food in this part of the American West. But can you explain why the Fish and Wildlife Service came to adopt the use of chemical pesticides and herbicides on the refuges by the 1940s? And why was this omitted in Silent Spring?
Certainly many people would know that we have used in the past, and we still use lots of insecticides and herbicides on our farmland throughout the U.S., mm-hmm. including the area near the refuges. But one of the things that I discuss in my book is how many of these chemicals, DDT, a very infamous insecticide, and 2,4-D, a very important herbicide mm-hmm. to kill weeds, were both used on the wildlife refuges by the Fish and Wildlife Service. And they're used because in the post-war period, many of these refuges also become farms. They're growing grains, sometimes barley, sometimes rice, to feed the birds. And so instead of harvesting this crop completely for private purposes to sell on the market, you would harvest or leave some of this crop standing for these birds to eat as a way to feed and contain and corral the birds in the refuges, so they would not feed on the surrounding private farmland. But if you're going to grow a large monoculture at the time, you're going to have problems with insect pests and with mm-hmm. weeds. And then also the Fish and Wildlife Service, since they're not experienced farmers, they're going to turn to advice to the prevailing, to other farmers, to government land management agencies for advice on how to grow crops. And if you're going to do that in the 1950s and the 1960s, you're going to be using pesticides. And so they feel that if they're going to feed grain to the waterfowl, they need to preserve those crops. And mm-hmm. the best way that they feel they can do that is by using pesticides.
And Rachel Carson writes about the use of pesticides in Silent Spring in 1962, but doesn't mention the Fish and Wildlife Service's use of these very same pesticides and herbicides that are critiqued in that book.
Yeah, she doesn't talk about it, certainly doesn't talk about it extensively, and she wasn't, as some of the listeners may know, she had worked for the Bureau of Biological Survey and then worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service when it changed its name and some of its responsibilities. So she spent a good portion of her career as a government bureaucrat before she became this famous naturalist that we know. She's certainly very well aware of the pesticides that are used around and the impacts of it, but you know why she doesn't talk about the use of the Fish and Wildlife Service using these pesticides is somewhat a mystery to me why she doesn't talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So in what other ways did the Bureau of Biological Survey and Fish and Wildlife Service struggle to manage what you characterize as a mobile resource?
Well, one of the problems is, I mean, if you're, say, a duck or a goose flying over the Central Valley of California, and you're looking down like a bird's eye view of this Central Valley, one of the most productive agricultural regions on the planet, when they look down, I mean, part of that valley is turned into rice fields, which is basically a type of wetland. It's a monocrop, but it's a type of a wetland with standing water. And standing rice is something that at least some species of waterfowl, particularly ducks, can eat and feed on. So when they look at the landscape, it's not that the landscape has been completely destroyed. There's actually places in that landscape that they can go and feed. But obviously, if you have 20 or 30,000 ducks landing into your field, I mean, these ducks can wipe out a field, a few acres of rice in just a night. And so the farmers are quite concerned about this. So once the refuges are set up and the ducks and geese are seen as a public resource with an agency, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that is partially responsible for them, that agency becomes responsible of essentially segregating that the landscape, of trying to get these ducks and geese into the wildlife refuges.
And this is really at the crux of this conflict, to a certain extent, then, between farmers and the refuge managers over this period. Can you talk a little bit about how that relationship changed over time in the 20th century?
Sure. I mean, back in the 40s and 50s, when you really have a lot of conflicts over water. They both really have a stake in this very important resource. But also, the farmers have a lot of political clout, and they want the birds out of their fields. One of the things that I did not mention is one of the ways to do it is the Fish and Wildlife Service would actually fly planes, surplus planes from World War II, using surplus ordnance, and they would actually drop hand grenades into flocks of ducks and geese. Now, apparently these were some sort of sound grenade. They weren't, like, blowing the ducks and geese to smithereens.
Right.
But so this explosion would go up, the ducks and geese would fly up, and then the pilot would essentially be like a cowboy herding cattle and would herd these birds back into the refuge. And that's a very clear example of how you're trying to separate birds from the surrounding agricultural landscape. But to get back to your question, one of the things that changes as the decades go on is that there are now more and more demands on water in California, particularly urban areas that want the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of seeing the birds as always a threat to their crops, and now in a way they see the birds as an ally, particularly rice farmers, because rice farming takes a tremendous amount of water, and people in cities are saying, like, well, the much better use of that water is for metropolitan uses. Mm-hmm. And so now they're saying that actually our rice fields provide important habitat for the migratory birds that predominantly urban people like to view. And so in their way, unwittingly, the birds are simply brought in as allies to try and protect and preserve the water rights that these rice farmers are trying desperately to hold on to in a state that is becoming more urban by the day, and urban water demands are increasing by the day.
Now, farmers are just one of the groups of actors in this story that you trace out in the book. The refuge managers are there as well, the irrigation district managers, but the game hunters also
yes.
play a prominent role in this history. Can you explain what role hunting plays in the development of the refuge system?
Well, the refuges are originally set up as sanctuaries, and they're seen as sanctuaries from unscrupulous hunters, particularly market hunters, people who are hunting these birds, not just ducks and geese, but other birds such as egrets and herons, mm-hmm. To sell their bodies or their feathers on the market. And also sport hunters who would be seen at the time as unscrupulous sport hunters. So the refuges are set up in part to protect the birds from the ravages of hunters. But as time goes on, the biggest supporters of the wildlife refuges become duck and geese hunters. And what they demand is they want more and more refuges set up, but they don't want them set up as sanctuaries. They want them set up as essentially public hunting grounds in a landscape that has become increasingly private.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are hunting clubs that are set up in different parts of California and Oregon, to name just two states. But these are hunting clubs where you have to pay a fee. They're private. They're exclusive. So they call upon the Fish and Wildlife Service to create places for what are called unattached hunters, hunters that are not affiliated with clubs. So they have a place to hunt this. And so this sort of class dynamic comes in. I mean, most of these hunters are not impoverished people, but it becomes kind of a battle between hunters of relatively modest means and wealthy hunters to ensure there are places in that landscape for them to hunt, and the refuges become that.
Now, that relationship with hunting, though, as you discussed toward the end of the book, changes. In what way does the sort of history of these refuges get disrupted by the late 20th century and the early 21st century with the introduction of modern environmentalists into this equation? How does modern environmentalism complicate or challenge the refuge system in the West?
Well, until the 1970s, I mean, these refuges are set up, the main supporters are sport hunters. And it's just basically assumed that even though you might have dozens of species, of bird species, using these refuges, they're essentially set up for the dozen or so species of ducks and geese that use them and are prized by hunters. It doesn't mean the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't care necessarily about the other birds, but they were not, or even the other species, be it fish or mammals or amphibians that use mm-hmm. the refuges, but they were not a priority. But with the rise of the environmental movement, and quite frankly, the decline of hunting is there are fewer and fewer hunters every year, particularly relative to the rest as a percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. So their influence is waning. And there are environmentalists who are coming in and valuing these landscapes, not just for the ducks and geese, but for endangered species that might be on these refuges, endangered species of fish or less common amphibians. And so environmentalism is going to bring a broadening of views of what is valuable in this landscape, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to follow suit, partly because of pressure by environmentalists, but also because of new scientific knowledge of the importance of all these other species in maintaining a healthy ecosystem.
And the relics of the connection between refuges and hunting still persist, right, even at the Rifle Refuge in the Lower Mainland.
Oh. Yes, absolutely. I mean, hunting has not gone away, and there's still an important part. I mean, part of this legacy, at least in the United States, is that when you had a sport hunter go and get a license, they would get a state license, but they would also get what's called a duck stamp, which mm-hmm. is essentially a federal permit of some sort for them to hunt. And money from that, a fair chunk of the money from that, garnered from those duck stamps would go to buy other wildlife refuges and to maintain them. So those two things together would become obviously an enormous incentive for the Fish and Wildlife Service to serve the needs of hunters.
And the Fish and Wildlife Service, as you described it, was a particularly weak bureaucracy in the U.S. federal bureaucracy. But you argue that their power is shifted in the 1970s, particularly through the Endangered Species Act. Can you explain how the Endangered Species Act changed the power of the Fish and Wildlife Service?
Sure. Until the 1970s, the Fish and Wildlife Service had some sort of power on landscapes outside the refuges, but it was rather limited. But with the passage of the Endangered Species Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service becomes the primary, not the only, but the primary agency responsible for enforcing that act. And that has ramifications not only on the wildlife refuges that it manages, but on other landscapes. It mm-hmm. has impact on other federal projects, say, the Bureau of Reclamation in its kind of attempt to, say, build a dam or to expand an irrigation network, if that is impacting an endangered species, the Fish and Wildlife is going to have a say. Mm-hmm. And so it dramatically increases the power of that agency.
And you are describe a bit of a conflict as a shift in power then between local farmers and refuges in Northern California and the border with Oregon.
Sure. Oh, go ahead. Did you have the...
No. Go ahead.
Okay, sure. There's a controversy that had been brewing since the 1990s, but really exploded in 2001 in what became known as the Klamath Water War. And what happened at that time is that there were a number of species of endangered fish species, endangered or threatened fish species, the short-nosed sucker, the Lost River sucker, and a species of salmon, the coho salmon. Mm-hmm. They're all either endangered or threatened in that area, and in 2001 was a particularly dry year, and so there wasn't enough water to go around, and the Fish and Wildlife Service ordered the Bureau of Reclamation to shut off water, or to ensure that there was enough water in a number of key lakes in the Klamath Basin to for the benefit of these endangered or threatened fish. And so what the Bureau of Reclamation did, it basically cut off water deliveries to virtually all the farmers that were serviced by the Bureau of Reclamation in their Klamath project. Mm-hmm. And this leads to an enormous controversy between environmentalists, the Fish and Wildlife Service, between the Bureau of Reclamation, as well as native peoples who also had a claim on these fish and traditionally harvested these fish. And so it becomes essentially, it's quite complicated, but essentially the transformation that you're seeing is the lessening power of the Bureau of Reclamation and the farmers that they serve. I mean, mm-hmm. it would have been unfathomable for something like that to happen 40 years ago. I mean, just would have been unthinkable for something like that to happen back then.
So to a certain extent, then, by the 21st century, fish become the senior water rights holders?
Yes, exactly, because they essentially trump the interest in the water rights of many other of landowners in the basin. And that's one of the reasons it's so controversial, is because many of these people say, like, I have senior water rights. How can the needs of these other species, reviled species, at least in the sense mm-hmm. of many of the farmers, mm-hmm. these two species of suckerfish, override the water that they feel that they need and are entitled to by the federal government?
So I guess just in conclusion here, I want to get some of your ideas about something you mention in the book, and you relate your research to some of the arguments of Mark Feig as it relates to the relationship between private property and ecological commons. In what way is your research contributing to this argument or modifying this argument?
Well, Mark's argument is basically saying that when you have landscapes of mobile forms of nature, and that could be weeds blowing and the seeds of weeds blowing from one farm to another. It could be fire spreading across the landscape. It could be deer. In my case, it's migratory birds. And that we have, under a very sort of modern system of dividing land, we have really hard and fixed boundaries that are seen on maps. But the problem is nature is mobile, and there's no more mobile part of nature than migratory birds, which cross hundreds of miles. So he says when you have situations like that where you have a resource or some aspect of nature that's crossing all these borders, you often have the development of an ecological commons, a common interest, and people have to come together to deal with this resource. And you certainly see that with the migratory birds. Sometimes that can be, from our perspectives, or what I would say, very negative, in that you have farmers applying pressure to the Fish and Wildlife Service to deal with this resource that is crossing the landscape. You have a public resource, and essentially in the 40s and 50s, let's put this public resource, the birds, into mm-hmm. the part of the landscape we have designated for public use, and that's the refuges. So that could be an example of the ecological commons. So I'm really building in some ways on some of Mark's arguments that he has made in other works.
Well, the book is fascinating, whether you're a birder or not, or a hunter or not. It's Seeking Refuge, Birds and Landscapes of the Pacific Flyway by Bob Wilson. Bob, I want to thank you for joining us and letting us know a little bit more about your book.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Bob Wilson and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate this podcast and write a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. If you have any ideas for new episodes or you want to send me some feedback, contact me through my website at seancourage.com. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next month with another episode of Nature's Past.